Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of things that have been accomplished amongst us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have declared them to us, it seems good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught.
One of the most common reasons I'm given by people who aren't Christians for the reason why they're not Christians is that they simply just can't trust the Gospels as history. They simply can't trust that what's written in the Gospels actually happened. We're looking at Luke this evening. Let's take Luke as an example. I totally understand this point of view. For instance, on the first page of Luke's Gospel, we read that Jesus is immaculately conceived. Jesus, the baby, is born without his mum and his dad having sex. And that is hard for us to understand. That is hard for us to believe. A few pages on, we see Jesus talking to Satan in a desert. Now pretend for a moment that you haven't heard these stories before. Imagine hearing this for the first time. This is hard to believe. Over the next 20 or so pages of Luke's Gospel, you're going to read about exorcisms. You're going to read about miracle mass feedings. You're going to read about healings of incurable diseases. And on the very last page, you read that Jesus, after being crucified, after definitely being killed on a cross, 2 days later, rises from the dead for everybody to see. Now, as a result, these people are telling me that they simply can't trust the Gospels as history. Either plonk Luke's Gospel into the fiction pile, or they pile it into the metaphor pile. But they certainly don't plonk it in the historically reliable pile. And doing this is good news for us, isn't it? It's really good for us to do that. Because it means that if we can disregard the stuff that Jesus did as fiction, then we can also disregard the stuff that Jesus said as fiction. We can disregard the stuff that Jesus said about how every single one of us in this room right now is spiritually lost. Naturally, spiritually lost, and only he is capable of making us found. We can disregard the stuff that Jesus says about us being naturally enemies of God, and that only he can bring us back to God. If we can disregard the stuff that happened in the Gospels as fiction, we can disregard the stuff that he said. So we can take it or leave it, but I'm not satisfied with that. Because you read Luke's Gospel, and I think we see two things. Firstly, that Luke's Gospel has got historical credibility. And secondly, that Luke's Gospel brings personal certainty. So two things. Luke's Gospel has historical credibility. Secondly, Luke's Gospel brings personal certainty. Firstly, Luke's Gospel has historical credibility. We've got to ask the question first. What was Luke's intention as he wrote this Gospel? According to Richard Dawkins, you're going to get a lot of Dawkins tonight, I think he's brilliant. According to Richard Dawkins, in his bestseller, The God Delusion, the Gospels can't be trusted for two reasons. Firstly, they're myth and legend. They are, his own words, copied and recopied through many different Chinese whispers generations. And secondly, they can't be trusted because the four writers of the Gospels more than likely never met Jesus personally, and that much of what they wrote was in no sense an honest attempt at history. Was in no sense an honest attempt at history. Therefore, according to Dawkins, it was never Luke's intention to document the stuff that he's writing as historically reliable. It was never meant to be read as history. According to Dawkins, Luke's intention was for you to read his gospel in the same way that you would read The Curious Incident of a Dog in the Nighttime or Alice in Wonderland. It's in the same category according to Dawkins. But look with me at verse 3, if you will. Now this is from the prologue of Luke's gospel. It seemed good to me. It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account. To write an orderly account. Now, to me, that sounds a little bit like an attempt, an honest attempt, at history. Notice, if you will, that there's a clear structure to this prologue. It's got a dedication to a man called Theophilus, and then it's got a purpose statement. Now, why am I pointing that out to you? I'm pointing this out to you because that structure is typical of historical works of the first century. On your handout, I've got another example of a piece of history from the first century. What I'd like you to do is look at Luke's Gospel. Look at the verses we're studying from Luke's Gospel whilst I read this quote from Josephus. Note the similarities. In my history of our antiquities, most excellent Epaphroditus, I have, I believe, made sufficiently clear to any who may peruse that work the antiquity of our Jewish race. However, since I noticed that a considerable number of persons, influenced by the malicious slanders of certain individuals, discredit the statement of my history, I deem it my duty to devote a brief treatise to all these points, in order at once to convict our detractors, to correct the ignorance of others, and to instruct all who desire to know the truth concerning the antiquity of our race. Can you see what Josephus is doing there? Same thing as Luke. Dedication, this time to a person called Epaphroditus, followed by purpose statement. Luke is written in exactly the same way as other documents from the first century that are written as history. Now, one of Dawkins' major problems with Luke's Gospel is that it deals with miracles. Now, I'm not saying that it's easy for us to imagine the stuff that Luke describes as happening. Like I said, we're dealing with exorcisms, miracle feedings, the dead coming back to life. If you're reading it with any sense of your intellect switched on, that is going to jar with your ears. It's not normal for these things to happen. But just because it doesn't sound normal to us, that doesn't mean that Luke didn't intend for it to be written as history. Luke's intention was that this book was to be read as history. Secondly, when did Luke write this? Once again, according to Dawkins, many years after Jesus' death. And he says, in fact, so long after Jesus' death that many details would have been forgotten. I think we can date Luke's Gospel a lot earlier. Certainly a lot earlier than many years later. For instance, if you turn to Luke 21, please, you don't have to do that now. But in Luke 21, Jesus tells this story, or makes a prediction about the fall of Jerusalem. He describes, or he predicts it in real graphic detail. He tells us that a very particular army is going to attack Jerusalem. He even describes the way that this army is going to attack Jerusalem. Now this is a big deal that Jesus, this is a big deal of a prediction. Jerusalem wasn't just any old city in the Middle East. Jerusalem was the center point of Jewish religion. If Jerusalem falls, then Judaism falls. It's a big deal. It's not the sort of thing that Luke would forget to mention if he knew that it ended up happening. In fact, in elsewhere in the Gospels, when Jesus makes predictions about events that later come true, the Gospel writers tell us about it. For instance, in John 21, when Jesus is talking about how Peter's going to die, and then John writes, obviously after Peter's death, This was fulfilled in the way that Peter died. You know the story. But with this prediction about the fall of Jerusalem, Jesus' very particular description, the Gentile army, the way they surround Jerusalem, he doesn't make any mention of that prediction ever coming true. Now, there are two options as to why that is. Either Luke didn't think it was important to mention. And we are talking about the end of Judaism. I think we can assume that it's a reasonably important fact. Either Luke didn't think it was important, or it hadn't happened by the time that Luke wrote this gospel. The fall of Jerusalem happened in AD 70. So Luke must have been written before AD 70. It must have been written before AD 70. But I think we can go further back. You know that Luke is the first of a two-part work. Luke's Gospel and the follow-up, the sequel, Acts. The second half of Acts follows the life of the Apostle Paul, once again wanting to document his life. You'd think that, you know, the small detail of Paul dying, if Luke knew about it, would have been written about in Acts, if it had happened by the time that Luke writes Acts. But at the end of Acts, Paul is still alive. He is in Rome, he's under house arrest, but he's able to go about his gospel preaching business. We know that Paul died at the latest 65 AD, probably even 62, 63 AD. And there's no mention of this in Acts. Which means that Luke's gospel, which is, remember, the first part of this two-volume work, must have been completed by at least 64 AD. And not just finished by 64 AD, but in wide circulation, because in Paul's second letter to Timothy, he quotes Luke. So not only was it written, completed by 65 AD, completed for Theophilus, but widely circulated and known by Paul, known so well that he's able to quote it in his letter to Timothy. We can date Luke's gospel to 61, 62, 63 AD. Do you know how significant that is? We're talking within the lifetime of the people that are mentioned in the gospels. You know, people that when they read the gospels, if what Luke is saying didn't happen the way that he describes it, these people, all they need to do is say, "I was there. That is not the way it happened." But no one did that. Because everybody who read Luke's gospel that was actually mentioned in Luke's gospel just said, "That's right, that's exactly how it happened." If anybody was able to quash it in the first century when they first read it, because they were there and it happened differently, they would have. And we wouldn't have Luke's gospel today. But no one did. Because it's historically reliable. But how did he write it? Well, verse 3 tells us. Luke tells us that he has followed all things closely for some time past. Does that mean that Luke followed the life of Jesus from the moment of Immaculate Conception all the way to the cross and beyond? No. That's not what it means. And you wouldn't believe me even if I told you that's what happened. So what does Luke mean when he says that he's followed all things closely for some time past? It means that he's done exactly the same that any decent historian would do today. He's searched out other narratives that have been compiled about the life of Jesus. He's cross-referenced these other narratives. He's found out what's consistent. He's looked them up and he's used them. Look at verse 1. He tells us this. "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us." Luke is saying here, up front, others have written accounts of the life of Jesus, and I've used those. I've based parts of my gospel on works that other people have written. Now, he's definitely talking here about Mark's gospel. He's definitely talking about Mark's gospel. Now, why? How can I be so certain? Because if you compare the two gospels, one third of Luke's gospel is taken almost line for line from Mark, which means that we can date Mark back even further. Luke also tells us that he searched out eyewitnesses and he interviewed them. He performed an investigation. Look at verse 2. "Just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us." Luke is saying, "I found the people present and I checked out the facts. I've cross-examined them. These people have filled me in on the details." In the Da Vinci Code. I love the Da Vinci Code as well. In the Da Vinci Code, you remember that? I hope you've seen it. you know that creepy guy that walks around with the sticks that lives in the woods? In a chateau in France? You know, the professor of theology from the University of the Discovery Channel or something. But Lee Teabing. I'm going to completely take him out of context here. Because I think there's something he says, if you take it out of context, sums up precisely the point I'm trying to make. Li Tibing, in the Da Vinci Code, tells us that the Gospels, they didn't fall magically from the clouds. They didn't fall magically from the clouds. Man created them. Man created it as a historical record of tumultuous times. And that's absolutely right. This is a historical record of difficult times. Wonderful times, but difficult times. But it's historical. This isn't legend. This isn't Chinese whispers. This isn't ancient fiction, to use a term that Dawkins loves to use. This isn't ancient fiction. This is real. This is historical. If it wasn't, it would never have gotten off the ground. So that's my first point. It's historically credible. But secondly, Luke's gospel brings personal certainty. It's not just a book that's historically reliable. Because this book, if you read it, will change your life. It will change your life. It dawned on me this morning when I was thinking about this that Luke seems to go to an awful lot of trouble, doesn't he? Don't you think? He's searched out other documents about Jesus. He's read them all. He's cross-referenced them. He's searched out eyewitnesses. It's years of work. And why has he done this? Why has he gone to this trouble? Verse 3 tells us, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. All the trouble that Luke goes to is for the sake of one person. All this trouble is in order for one person to have certainty about Jesus Christ. I think that's really odd. All that trouble for one person. Who is this guy? Who is this Theophilus guy? Well, the book is dedicated to most excellent Theophilus. In the first century, that's just a way that you refer to somebody of significance, somebody of status. It's like saying to, it's like one member of parliament referring to another member of parliament as my honourable friend. It's just a member of significance within, a person of status within the Roman Empire. If he were alive today, Theophilus would be the guy working on the very top floor of one of the buildings around here. He'd be the guy working in Whitehall. He would be the advisor to the government. And it's to a guy like this that Luke says, I've gone to all this trouble, you need to hear this. You need to hear what's written down here. So what does that mean for us? That means that you could be the most important person in this room. You could be the most important person in Canary Wharf, and this message is for you. Luke's gospel is written for a person just like you. But the thing is, it's not just for the people who've made a success of their life. This gospel, if you read it through, you'll see is also a message for the poor and for the lowly. We'll see that Jesus repeatedly chooses to spend time with people that we would refer to as tramps and people that have made a real mess of their lives. So what does that mean? Let's put the two things together. It means that tonight, if you are that guy that works on the top floor of the building, or you are that guy that has screwed up his life and is sleeping in the doorway, this gospel is for you. This message is for you. Theophilus wasn't a religious man. He wasn't brought up going to the synagogue twice on a Saturday. He wasn't that guy that you were in uni with that had never seen a television before. This guy was a Gentile. He had no Christian background, no religious background. We know that from his name. And it's to a guy like this that Luke says, you need to hear this. No background, no religious influence. You need to hear this. So tonight, this isn't just a message for people brought up in a Christian home. This is a message for you that has just wandered in tonight, just wondering what's going on that boat. This is a message for you. Luke's gospel is for you, for people that aren't religious at all, that would hate to call themselves religious. This gospel that Luke's written is for you. But he was curious, wasn't he? He was curious. He was made curious about this Christianity. Look at verse 4. Luke wants to give him certainty of the things that he's already been taught. This guy knows something about Christianity already. In fact, I reckon he embodies the condition of most of the people in the Roman Empire by this time in history. At the end of Acts, we read of how the whole of the Roman Empire has got something to say about Christianity. And Theophilus here is no different. He's got questions. Is that you? Have you got questions about Christianity? Are you here tonight because you want to know more? Maybe you're here tonight because you came last week and you heard a testimony of how Jesus has literally changed Eleanor's life. He has changed a girl's life, and you're here this week because when you heard that last week, it just didn't fit with your framework of who Jesus is, because as far as you were concerned, he was a good man, a good teacher, a pretty good carpenter, but certainly incapable of changing somebody's life 2,000 years later. You are curious, and that's why you're here tonight. Maybe you've seen the effect Christianity has had on one of your friends. Maybe you've noticed that you've got a Christian friend that doesn't seem to blow his top like you do. Maybe you've got a Christian friend who seems to be so much more patient with her kids than you ever could be. Maybe you've got a Christian friend that isn't freaking out about this impending recession in the same way that you are. And that's made you curious. You want to know more. Luke is for you. Luke's gospel tells us that this interest, this curiosity, can become certainty. How? Just through reading it. You can be certain of these things. You can be certain that Jesus is real, that he changes lives. How? You can be certain by just reading his gospel. I don't know, maybe you've seen one of those buses this week that say there's probably no God. Your conscience tells you otherwise. And you've asked a Christian friend, is there a God? And they say, yes, there is. So you've come here tonight. You want to be made certain. Is there a God? Is there a God? Tell me, I need to know. Read Luke's gospel. You'll find out. And you can be certain. Maybe you're someone who, as far as you can see it, you've made a total mess of your life. You've made a series of wrong decisions. You've screwed it all up, and now you're wondering, is there any hope for me? You've asked a Christian friend, is there any hope for somebody like me? And they've said, yes, you've come tonight. You want an answer. Is there any hope for me? Read Luke's gospel. You'll see there really is. There really is hope for you. You can be certain. Read Luke's gospel. Maybe tonight you're racked with guilt about something you've done long in the past. Is there anything that I can do to deal with this guilt? Is there any way I can know forgiveness? There is. Read Luke's gospel. It's amazing. You can have certainty. There's a longing deep within every single one of us for something that is far outside us. And through reading Luke's gospel, we can be certain of the answer to that longing. Luke's gospel isn't just intellectually stimulating. It isn't just intellectually satisfying. It doesn't just answer all those questions of historical reliability. Luke's gospel will lead you to answering that deepest longing in your heart. It will give you certainty about Jesus. It'll give you certainty about God. It'll give you certainty about life. It'll give you certainty about forgiveness. It'll give you certainty about what happens after death. It's not just wishful thinking. It's real, and it can be believed.